Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there, welcome to a surprise Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. No doubt many of you are still digesting the big long Arscast extra that James and I produced on Monday, looking back at the Liverpool game, the fallout, the repercussions, the performance, the manager, the board, all that kind of stuff. There was a lot to talk about, so we talked about it. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, please do, because we made it especially for you. Honestly, just, yeah, for you, honest. Yeah, you. Yeah. So don't let us down. Please, please have a listen. But this is a different kind of an Arscast. But one of the things, obviously, that came up on the Arscast Extra was Stan Kroenke, his ownership, the board, etc., etc. And it tied in very nicely with a new book that has been released by a journalist called James Montague. And the book is called The Billionaires Club, The Unstoppable Rise of Football Super Rich Owners. And it looks at the way that football clubs are now increasingly being run and managed and owned by extremely wealthy people from all over the world. So the book is in more or less four parts. Part one is Eastern Europe, including Russia, etc., etc. Then we've got America, Asia, and then the Middle East. And of course, Arsenal are in a situation where the majority of our shares are owned by one man, but the majority of the rest of the shares are owned by another man, Ali Shahrouzmanov. So we've got two billionaire owners, two billionaire shareholders, I should say, and, well, it's a complicated situation. People are very exercised about Stan Kroenke, but is Ali Shahrouzmanov any better? Is it better the devil you know? Maybe it's not, but I wanted to talk to James about the situation in general, about the way football clubs are being owned, about the impact it's having on the game, and about the impact it may well have on the game in the future. And of course, we talk about it from an Arsenal perspective as well. We touch on Usmanov, we touch on Stan Kroenke, the way he operates, the way Usmanov operates, and of course, it ties in with people like Roman Abramovich, Sheikh Mansour at Manchester City, the Qatari influence at PSG. It's a really fascinating book. It's called The Billionaires Club, The Unstoppable Rise of Football's Super Rich Owners. You can check it out on Amazon. It's available on Kindle, hardcover, and also audiobook as well, I think via Audible. So there's some links on the website, on arsblog.com, on the post that accompanies this podcast. So now let's just get on with it. Let's chat to James Montague about billionaires, about Stan Kroenke, about Ali Shahrouzmanov, about Arsenal, and lots more. Can you just maybe give me a bit of background about the book itself and where the idea came from?
Yeah, the book is about the super rich, the 1%, the billionaire class, basically, who have become absolutely embedded in the game. And I wanted to find out who they were, where they made their money from, and whether that was problematic or not, and what their involvement in football tells us about the direction the game is going in. And the idea came from this is my third book. My first book was called When Friday Comes, and it was about football in the Middle East. And it had nothing to do with finance or anything highfalutin like that. I mean, it was just me rolling around kind of getting into scrapes in various Middle Eastern kind of scenarios while watching football. Right. But when it came out, the same week it came out, Sheikh Mansour bought Manchester City. And I remember the coverage. I mean, a lot of people, because when they put, they obviously didn't know who this guy was, knew nothing about the Middle East or football, and had put my name into Google, and I was the only name that came up, because I was pretty much the only person writing about that part of the world in football at the time. And what was interesting was that I'd lived in the UAE, and I'd known about the way that football was, not just football was run there, but society was run there, and that It wasn't a particularly ethical place. There was no such thing as private wealth. Any royal family member that was investing was doing it because of a wider strategy. They obviously had a huge problem with you know, indentured slavery, and effectively the kafala system, which we all now know and have heard about because of Qatar in 2022, is alive and well, and probably even worse in the UAE than it is in Qatar. So when that happened and he bought Manchester City and then spent a horrific amount of money straight away. I think it was something like 500 million in the first couple of transfer windows. Then, you know, I started thinking, well, you know, there's got to be a reason why these people are investing in it, and maybe we should start looking into it, because they're investing in other parts of the world, in other businesses, in other countries, and, you know, never really for much positive effect for the people there. So I wanted to apply that to football. And so, yeah, I had that idea then, and then it gestated for a few years, and this seemed to be the right time to write it.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because you're talking about the 1%, and it's like the 1% of the 1%, I think.
Yeah.
These people with vast amounts of money, vast amounts of wealth, resources, and football, generally speaking, is not what you would consider a high returns business in terms of what you get back, you know? So, I mean, is there a common thread in terms of what's driven these people to invest in football clubs? Is it an ego thing? Is it because perhaps they're really, really farsighted and we're seeing football's revenues increase because of television deals, et cetera, et cetera? But, I mean, if you've already got that much wealth, it's not about making yourself that much richer, is it?
It's absolutely about self-interest. That's the only common thread that connects the super rich. It's about self-interest. Now, that can take different forms, and it's different for different clubs. Because, for instance, if you look at PSG and Manchester City, I mean, both of those clubs are effectively owned by a country. If you look at PSG, Qatar Sports Investment, that is absolutely directly, you know, state-owned sovereign investment vehicle that has bought that club. Manchester City, they claim, is a little bit more diffuse. Sheikh Mansour is a member of the Abu Dhabi royal family. They say it's private wealth, but there's no real such thing as private wealth in the United Arab Emirates. And it's certainly fitted into the kind of into the strategy of that country and of that emirate. So for them, self-interest is a very almost a political aim to own a football club. For others, the self-interest can be seen especially relevant for Arsenal fans. And especially when you look at American owners, when we say that football is not a business that has a huge profit margin, and that's been true in the past. The issue is that I think David Goldblatt called it a pygmy compared to other businesses. I mean, I think he said that the average profit margin of a football club is comparable to a local branch of Tesco's, which is probably quite true when you look at the numbers. But what it is with American owners, and with the book, I kind of split it up into geographical areas. So you had the Middle East, you had Asia, you had Russia and Eastern Europe, and you had America. And especially with North American ownership, what a lot of those owners have come in doing is that they've made their money in working out how to make profit from sports franchises. And so all of them have a huge track record in that. I mean, if you look at the Glazers, I mean, their first port of call was the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the NFL, and they didn't know anything. And famously, the Mountain Glazers didn't know anything about you know, American football, but saw it as, you know, a kind of a money making machine, which of course is. It's a cartel, it's a closed shop. You know, this is the most valuable, richest sports league in the world. And that's because there's no promotion relegation. And it's just about, you know, once you're in that club, it's very difficult to basically not make money in that club.
Yeah.
And so Kroenke comes from that stock. He comes from he had the St. Louis. Well, first the LA Rams, moved them to St. Louis. And this is a guy who knows how to make money out of sports franchises. And that's why a lot of American owners are coming to English soccer, but not necessarily only English soccer. I mean, we can see this in Italy, France, all across the world, really, that Americans are investing in football because they do see that there is a far-sighted growth in this industry, that soccer is undervalued, and that unlike American sports franchises, which have a very limited growth, although they're hugely profitable, they could be hitting an upper ceiling of what they could be worth. Soccer has this incredible potential marketplace, which is the world. You know, it has still has China. It still has as an underdeveloped market. It still has India as an underdeveloped market. Even if you put it in places that are traditional cricket markets like Bangladesh and Pakistan, you have Africa still, you know, with its growing middle class. Even North America, you know, where we see the growth of MLS there. So for them, this is there is enough potential there to make significant profit.
Did you feel like in some ways, is there any sense that they perhaps want to or envisage an Americanization of the system in a way? Because you talk about the NFL, there's no promotion, there's no relegation. I think your quote in the book says the NFL is a cartel untroubled by failure unless it's a failure to make money. And that sounds like something that will ring true to many Arsenal fans when they think of Stan Kroenke's majority shareholding.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look at all his other, well, we have to be careful here because, of course, he had to spin off many of his previous ownerships to his son. So he isn't technically in charge of the previous NBA franchise anymore. That's part of the deal that he got when he took full ownership of the St. Louis Rams. But I certainly think that it's not just Americans. It's not just American owners who are kind of pushing this. It's what I found was that when you looked at the elite clubs and the owners of the elite clubs, they're looking at the NFL and seeing like, that's how we need to protect our investment, these legacy brands. So for instance, the Chinese owner of AC Milan, they came in, of course, there was a huge problem about whether some of the documents were faked, but eventually the sale went through. Mm. And one of the first suggestions that was being made was to have a kind of closed shop Champions League, a kind of NFL type Champions League, where you had, you know, 32 legacy clubs that are in there. And, you know, that was it. You're chosen based on your Instagram following. You're chosen based on, you know, how many fans you have in China.
Yeah.
And no matter how good you are, you can't break into that club unless you can prove that you can make more money than the lowest team on that ladder. So I think there is an Americanization coming our way. And this is partly down to the economics as well of the domestic game, not just in Europe, but also in England, especially. We'll look at England specifically, but a few years ago, when you look at the kind of pie and how it's distributed when it comes to clubs' revenue, the turnstile, what fans contributed to that was very low, was overtaken by everything else in terms of commercial deals and in particular TV revenue. Arsenal actually was one of the last teams to turn where that dial switched to less than 50% because, of course, they'd invested so much in the Emirates Stadium. And so this is something that I think is the less power that fans have on match day when it comes to the bottom line of a club, I think the more dangerous it is for that kind of Americanization of football, which will see clubs further and further untethered from their geographical locations. And I think I say in the book, you know, I speak to other football journalists and they say that this will never happen. But I can really envisage a game that isn't really kind of almost country by country, or at least there'll be one tier that's completely global. So like a global Super League where it's impossible to join, there's no promotion relegation. And then a kind of second tier of kind of almost ran clubs that can't get into that kind of upper echelon, which I think would be, I mean, when I've mentioned that to one friend of mine, actually, he thought that's a great idea. Let them run away with, let those clubs go and they can be those super brands and we can have the game as we wanted it back in the day. But I don't think it would end up like that. I think it would end up being kind of a feeder system,
sure,
and a little more than that.
Yeah, that's what...
Like the Premier League will effectively be like the Eredivisie or something like that. You know, what we've done to other clubs with our financial might will be done to us in the future, you know.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I can really see a time even when clubs, you know, will start, you know, bidding. You know, cities will be bidding for clubs to move cities as they do in the American franchise system. Because, you know, at the end of the day, if... you know, 90% of your revenue is coming from Chinese betting companies or, you know, Chinese TV deals, you know, it will make more sense to move the brand to China.
Mm.
You know, and of course, there'll be some pushback from that. But at the end of the day, these are owners who are used to that. Stan Kroenke at St. Louis, when I went to St. Louis for this chapter of the book, He was the most hated man I've ever met, the most hated American I've ever met.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because you go there and the chapter on Kroenke basically opens up with a Rams fan talking about how much he hates Stan Kroenke. And I do wonder, certainly as Arsenal fans, we're looking at what's going on at the moment and we're feeling very exercised by the whole thing. And I don't think he is the most popular man in town, it would be fair to say.
No.
But I have to ask, does he care? I mean, does he care what Arsenal fans think of him? Because if he can talk about being a proud citizen of Missouri and then moving the Rams from St. Louis to Los Angeles, knowing fine well how that's going to go down with the people there. And also, of course, the system, the whole stadium issue there, whereby he wanted the local government, wasn't it, to build them a brand new stadium, otherwise they were leaving.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely screwing over the taxpayer there, the people who pay for the season tickets to go and see the Rams, you know. In some ways, he's accessible there now. I know Kroenke lives on a big ranch and he can be, you know, separate from people. But, you know, there's the distance of the Atlantic between him and Arsenal fans as well. So I'm wondering what you think he might think of Arsenal fans' opprobrium towards him.
I mean, I don't think he would. I don't think anybody likes to be kind of criticised. But if you, again, look at the example of the St. Louis Rams, if he's willing to agitate in that way to move the franchise back to LA after riding in there saying, you know, I'm a son of Missouri, I'm proud to bring the NFL back to, you know, to St. Louis, and he's willing to kind of alienate people in that way. I mean, I don't think it would touch him what's going on in Arsenal. You know, you've got to think that what matters here is not really whether he's loved. And that's the thing. That's why ego is often given as a reason for people to own football clubs or sports franchises. And often, you know, it's not. It's a very simple shorthand way of looking at it. That's almost the old way of looking at club ownership. You know, when you look at the kind of philanthropic millionaire, you know, throwing money at his local club, you know, that is, there's a touch of ego about that. And when I met Faxon Sinawatra, when he bought, you know, during the book, I meet him in Paris, although, of course, he's exiled from Thailand after being kind of deposed in a coup. He was quite simplistic about it as well. I mean, for him, it was kind of ego. But for these guys, it's about, you know, being, you know, they're not criticized for this in the US in a certain circles. They're seen as kind of business pioneers. You know, they're seen as kind of, you know, extremely good at their job, extremely good at making profit, and that is ultimately the most important thing in American sports ownership. I even quote him on several occasions where he's talked about the fact that kind of actually trophies aren't that important. You know, for fans, that's all that's important. You know, or whatever trophy it is that your club is at the level of, whether it's kind of avoiding relegation or maybe the League Cup, whatever. But for fans, that is absolutely the number one thing. And there is certainly a disconnect, I think, between that style of ownership and what fans expect here. And, you know, ultimately, you know, I mean, Arsenal are doing financially very well. I mean, they've got a huge amount of cash in the bank. You know, the value of Arsenal, if he decided to sell those shares, of course, he'd be making fabulous profit off that. I mean, a real profit, even for somebody who's a multi-billionaire, you know, something that would be noticed when it drops into his bank account. So I don't think he does care about that. I just think he's probably a little bit nonplussed as to why people kind of are upset that when, you know, they won the FA Cup.
And yeah.
A little bit upset, you know, when, okay, we're not in Champions League this year, but last year, you know, look at the run before. You know, it's that kind of attitude, you know.
The franchise itself is financially successful. That in itself is a thing to be proud of, or a thing to trumpet
exactly.
about. How much of what the way that Kroenke operates and has operated throughout his business life are we seeing in the way that Arsenal is being run? Because we know that he is married to the heiress, or one of the heiresses from Walmart. He served on the board of Walmart. Walmart as a corporation takes advantage of tax breaks. It tries to avoid minimum wage changes. You know, it gets involved politically to try and to stop things like increases in minimum wages. And there's a sort of a spendthrift approach to the way that they're run as businesses. And Arsenal fans certainly will feel that although money has been spent down the years by the club, that the ambitions that they talk about, or certainly the manager and the chief executive talk about, aren't in line with what has been spent. And by his very nature, Kroenke isn't a guy who wants to spend a lot of money, wants to make it, but he obviously doesn't want to spend it.
No, and I think that Arsenal have been run in a very kind of economically rational, but not very kind of sporting successfully way at all. I mean, that's his modus operandi. I mean, he isn't running it like, he's not running it like Ann Walton or you know, or the Walton family run. You know, it's not like he's not getting corporate welfare. There is a different business model here. In that respect, he has kind of hewed very close to the line of what other football club owners in the UK can acceptably accept. He's not demanding state subsidies from Islington Council, for instance.
Only I mean, because
he's not,
he can't.
He's not demanding that people are the cleaners are turned into interns or anything like that. You know, so in that respect, he's not quite. Hasn't quite dragged down Arsenal to the kind of level of the other franchises that he's done. But in terms of kind of his investment and his reluctance to kind of really spend the kind of money that's needed now, you know, that's plain for everybody to see. I mean, he's not going to go into the market and spend 150 million, 100 million in the most expensive transfer window since transfer windows existed. You know, that's just not going to happen. So he has tempered some of his more excessive franchise ownership kind of desires, I guess, or impulses. But it's certainly, when you look at it, and when I spoke to, you know, Arsenal fans in St. Louis, and there are still a couple of them, because, I mean, what I found is that he's so hated in St. Louis that people actually actively now support Tottenham if they support a soccer team, because that's the team that you know, Kroenke's team hates the most.
Yeah.
And so, which is crazy, you know. And they also just look at all the teams. You know, they are all financially extremely well run, but they have not had success. They're all terrible failures on the pitch, on the field. Mm. You know, the St. Louis Rams, when they eventually moved to LA, you know, were one of the worst performing franchises in NFL history. I mean, to be fair, when he moved them from LA in the first place, I mean, they were known as the greatest show on turf. You know, there was that, they won the Super Bowl. I think they made the final a couple of years later. They made the Super Bowl a couple of years later as well. You know, so it, you know, he brought some success initially, but then it just faded and faded and faded and faded. And the rot wasn't stopped.
Yeah.
And eventually he thought that the answer to that was to move it to another city. And overnight, the brand was doubled in size. And then when they got to LA, of course, they had a disastrous season. And you know, didn't. So, you know, it's kind of sad, really, you know.
Yeah.
But this is a guy, it's not as if people didn't know this is what he would be about. This is what he does.
Yeah, I mean, it seems clear that sporting success is not the top of his priority list.
No, definitely not. And you know, this is the thing. When I went to America to research this chapter and did a few other bits and pieces, it's absolutely clear. You know, and sports owners are seen. There's a great guy called Dave Zirin who's written a book called Bad Sports. And he's kind of he's a bit of a polemicist, but he's a very good writer on all sports, and especially kind of the gap between the rich and the rest of us when it comes to sports. And he says that there's a Caesar mentality, you know, that they turn up and they lift their thumb or drop their thumb. And that's how they're expected to be treated when they're at when they turn up in their stadiums, which they've obviously procured through leveraging hundreds of millions of dollars of state subsidies. Mm. But when they arrive in English sport in particular, they're not revered like that, which is one of the reasons why Hicks and Gillette straight away rubbed up against a different culture, which was disastrous for them and for Liverpool FC. So, you know, and it's the same here, but it's a different type of world now, which is this kind of wealth generation in football has kind of become acceptable now. And this kind of model is becoming much more acceptable now, because at the end of the day, it's not about like, actually, we need to ask questions about how people are investing in football. The question people are asking is, we need somebody like this. We need a billionaire.
Yeah.
Other clubs are saying we need somebody to compete. So it's people aren't questioning this until it fails.
Yeah, it's a domino effect in a way, isn't it? When one guy has one, then you've got to keep up with the Joneses and it sort of begets more billionaire owners. And I think you're right that, you know, it has become the norm where people don't, even this summer, everyone said, well, look, you know, Neymar, £222 million from Barcelona to PSG. I mean, it's crazy. But, you know, it's just getting your head around the idea that it is a country that is financing this deal, yeah. Not one football club buying a player from another football club. It's it has become the new norm in a way. And these people...
It has. And it started really with... I mean, we can go all the way back to any number of points where we can say that's where it changed. But there was a really interesting story, you know, around when Jack Walker took Blackburn as a Premier League title. And that was a moment that a lot of Premier League clubs were really scared because, you know, this was... He's, in a way, the kind of the missing link between the past class of owners in British football, in English football in particular, and this new, you know, class of super rich who invested from 2003 onwards with Roman Abramovich, because he had the money, but he was obviously an absolutely obsessed Blackburn Rovers fan. And that was really where the kind of wage inflation and the huge debt began to really grow with clubs. So then you get to a position in 2003 when Abramovich steps in. Chelsea were days away from going out of business because they had a £23 million loan that they couldn't pay. And so, you know, Abramovich just paid it, came in, paid cash and saved the club. You know, and this was all caused clubs overspending and overreaching and overborrowing because of the Jack Walker effect, but they didn't have their own Jack Walker, yeah. Uncle Jack. They had to go to banks and raise finance themselves. And obviously for many, and you look at Leeds United in particular, it was absolutely disastrous.
It was very interesting. I listened to you on the Second Captains podcast and you were talking about, I think Ken had asked you, you know, was there any sense of why it was that Roman Abramovich, who was pretty much a unheard of, very secretive man, all of a sudden became this hugely high profile figure when he came in to buy Chelsea. And people can speculate about whether it's, you know, being a presence in London, having this sort of more, what's the word I'm looking at? Not legitimate is not the right word, but, you know, just having this business there in London. And you tell the story of how the guy who was in doing the deal, is it Trevor Birch, the guy from Chelsea?
Yeah, Trevor Birch, the CEO. It's an interesting story about Trevor Birch because he's the CEO of Chelsea. You know, I mean, he's about to watch this club go under, doesn't know where this next payment's going to come from. Suddenly this fairy godfather comes in, the guy rolls in, they go and sit in a room together and they, you know, the deal's done in 15 minutes, shake hands and that's it. And he promptly lets Trevor Birch go shortly after, so he doesn't stay on the staff. But when I asked him, because I actually got hold of Trevor and interviewed him for the book, because in an amazing coincidence, he kind of comes at the end of the book as well, because I finish it in Portsmouth, which has kind of experienced all of these owners over a very short period of time. I mean, they had kind of the Serbian US owner, Milan Mandarić, and then they had that succession, you know, Gaidamak, Ali Al-Faraj, they didn't think existed from the Middle East. No one ever saw if he existed or not. And then you had Sulaiman Al-Fahim, the guy who famously did the Man City deal, was the face of the deal, was like very famous. The club obviously was the first Premier League club to go into administration. And then when it went into administration a second time, Trevor Birch was appointed as the administrator. And it was him that accepted the bid from the Pompey Supporters Trust because it was the only bid in town to clear any debt and to become still remain a viable business. That was accepted by the court, and Pompey Supporters Trust was allowed to buy Portsmouth FC, and they paid off the debt. They got promoted, and the club was run very successfully as the biggest supporter trust in the world and support club in the world. And it was, for me, that was a great circle to close. You know, that you're shaking hands with a guy in 2003. You know, which starts off this kind of arms race of billionaire football club ownership. And at the end, you're kind of playing this pivotal role in also, you know, laying the foundations for kind of a form of club ownership that I think is possibly the only way we can keep the game kind of grounded in any kind of locality. You know, and ultimately, when it comes to the reason for Abramovich buying it, it's so opaque, we don't know. What we do know is that everything that he said about it is probably wrong, because this guy is so secretive that when he came to prominence with, you know, as one of Vladimir Putin's most trusted oligarchs, Russian TV didn't even have a photo of him. You know, this is how secretive. And so to go then and buy a football club is preposterous to suggest that it was because it was, you know, he just wanted to have a good time. He just wanted to spend his money, which is what he told the BBC at the time. A far more likely reason is that Abramovich was a member of the oligarch class that got very rich under Boris Yeltsin. And this is the class of people that really took advantage of this collapsing the Soviet state, the collapse of communism, and hoovered up state assets at a fraction of their cost. Alisher Usmanov being another one of them, by the way.
Yeah, we're going to come to him now in a minute.
We'll come to him. And you know, who got incredibly wealthy off the back of these. Incredibly, I mean, you can argue the morality of it or the legality of it, but in both cases, you know, doesn't come up very well. Essentially, he buys an asset for $50 million that he ends up selling for, I think it was kind of $8 billion in the end, you know, horrifically undervalued. But all of that class who were enriched under Yeltsin, Yeltsin allowed this to happen in return for their political patronage and their support. It was a famous scheme called loans for share schemes. I say famous, it should be called infamous.
Yeah.
Many of those people who were enriched under Yeltsin would eventually have their fortunes taken away from them. Many were dead. Many have been thrown into jail, like Michael Khodorkovsky, who had Yukos Oil, was once the richest man in Russia. Anybody that showed any threat to Putin's power, and Putin got elected on a smash the oligarchs kind of ticket as well, you know, because they were extremely unpopular in Russia in 2000 when he was elected. Abramovich switched sides and straight away knew that Putin held the power, and so he has been one of his closest oligarchs and has done everything he's asked of him. He's become a governor of a faraway province. He's been instrumental in Russia, you know, in lobbying and also in funding the Russia 2018 bid. You know, there's this kind of story that he allegedly funded Putin's kind of huge yacht that a lot of oligarchs were asked to kind of pay. And Panorama did a big investigation on this. Of course, he denies it, but I mean, there's a lot of evidence out there for it. Mm. And all sorts of things, Putin's palace that he's contributed to allegedly. And so you can see Chelsea in that way as a kind of, and when I talk to people, they talk about an insurance policy, something that is gives him a non-threatening profile that makes it very difficult for him to be, to have his fortune stripped from him. Because everything, when you look at Abramovich's actions, everything is about keeping and maintaining that fortune. Mm. So I don't think you can look at Chelsea outside of that, outside of those kind of reasons.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Arsenal's situation, we talked about Stan Kroenke, but I think Arsenal's situation in terms of the football world, the football ownership world, is quite unique in the sense that there are two billionaires who own 97-98% of all the shares, more or less, in the club, but neither of them have ever put a penny into the club itself. They bought shares, but neither Usmanov or Kroenke have invested. We know that Usmanov is very much on the outside, and at this moment in time, Usmanov is seen in a much more favourable light than he was back when this battle between Kroenke and him took place first as to who was going to get the most shares and who was going to take control of Arsenal. I mean, maybe you could just fill people in a little bit about Usmanov and the kind of character that he is. And I know we have to be a little bit careful about some of the things we say about him, because I remember covering this story on the site a few years back and getting a very terse solicitor's letter from a very high-profile legal firm. London.
Yeah. he's very ready to send off the letters. I know all about that. But Usmanov is a, you know, Uzbek, I mean, Russian, but was born in Uzbekistan. Billionaire, one of the richest men in Russia. He has an extremely checkered past. I think that is absolutely fair to say. Yeah. I mean, he rose to prominence. I mean, he spent some time in jail. He says for a kind of KGB sting that went wrong. Regardless of that, he's become incredibly wealthy and was involved in the restructuring of Gazprom. And Gazprom is effectively a kind of a state-controlled kind of energy giant that has been used as a weapon of war and coercion against satellite states of Russia. So, you know, especially in Ukraine and other states where, you know, the threat of like turning off the gas during winter is used to have kept to keep kind of the political elites in line. And Usmanov now is a little bit in the same boat as Abramovich in that he is one of Putin's trusted oligarchs. And when Putin needs something to be done, Elisha Usmanov is there to do it. So when Putin wanted Russia, because it was suffering from sanctions after the Ukraine crisis, to bring back, because there's so much Russian capital overseas, bring back the money back to Russia as a patriotic duty. It was Usmanov that was the first one to bring two of his major businesses back into Russia. You know, when there's a troublesome TV, because one of the kind of quite smart things that Putin does, but which is kind of awfully evil as well, is if there's a troublesome TV network or newspaper or, in Usmanov's case, a social network site, VK, which is kind of the Russian Facebook, you know, who steps in to buy that and eventually turn that into a much more pro-Putin outlet? It's people like Abramovich. It's people like Usmanov. So they're absolutely front and center, playing a really integral role in kind of undermining Russian civil society and Russian freedom of speech. And I find that's not being talked about kind of absolutely baffling. Yeah. You know, this guy isn't just a businessman. He's a tool that Putin uses to, you know, silence critics in his own country. And it's amazing to me that can be not be talked about when it comes to Arsenal fans considering whether Usmanov is the kind of guy that you want involved in your club.
Yeah.
Because for me, that is... As bad as Kroenke is, in terms of his lack of investment but that's it. You know, he's a sharp ended, he's a kind of capitalist red in tooth and claw. Whereas Usmanov is this kind of middle ground, kind of a capitalist, but also a kind of cudgel with which Putin kind of attacks its opponents with. And so for me, Usmanov is a far more ethically compromised character to be involved with your club,
yeah,
than Kroenke ever can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just goes to show you what the level of feeling towards Kroenke is. I mean, I think you could put up Jack the Ripper with the other side of the shares, and people would find a way to say, "Well, this Jack the Ripper guy, he seems better than Kroenke." I mean, Usmanov is obviously very much on the outs when it comes to Arsenal. He doesn't have a seat on the board. We know that his partner has bought 49% of Everton, and it seems that maybe that's somewhere he would end up. But as the kind of character that he is, Would it be him having to accept some kind of failure when it comes to his investment in Arsenal to give that up and to move somewhere else?
Well, I think maybe it's pride, maybe it is ego. But I mean, he seems to genuinely, when you hear his pronouncements, he seems to genuinely be an Arsenal fan. I mean, I guess that's a difference here, I suppose, is that he talks the talk. I came across a leaked document the other day of a strongly worded letter from USM Holdings, you know, his company, to the board. They were absolutely livid because I can't remember who it was. I think it might be the chairman a few years ago, had contacted Megaphone, his kind of mobile phone operator.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In, his mobile phone operator that he owns in Russia, asking if they wanted to be the shirt sponsors, not knowing that he was the majority shareholder of it. And he took that as an absolute slap in the face. Like, you know.
It's very and, Arsenal. Fair enough. Very Arsenal, that. I
probably would as well. So he seems to be, there's no reason for him to hang around other than either he's the kind of guy who doesn't let things go, or that he genuinely is a fan. I mean, he could have easily got involved with Fahad Moshari in Everton. I mean, he could have easily got involved in that. And he's been investing in there. I believe he's sponsoring, or there's some kind of deal with the Everton training ground that he's been involved with. So you could see him moving into that area, but clearly he has some kind of attachment to Arsenal that is probably, he's ruling, by sticking around, he's ruling with his heart rather than his head.
But he's got to find somebody to buy his Arsenal shares, because Premier League rules won't allow him to own shares in the two clubs. And what he's got is a very, very valuable stakeholding in Arsenal. It's worth a lot of money based on the share prices and recent share transactions. He will not sell to Stan Kroenke because of the lack of relationship between the two men. I think that's the last thing he will do. The last thing either of them will do is sell to each other. So he's got to find somebody to buy his Arsenal shares. The difficulty, of course, is that who's going to buy 30 whatever percent of Arsenal, not knowing if you're going to have any influence at the club, not knowing if you're going to get a seat on the board. And if you're Stan Kroenke, regardless of who buys that shareholding, why would you divest your own power? Why would you dilute it to invite somebody else on the board when you have essentially total control, despite not owning all the shares?
Well, because, we were talking about football not being a business before, not being a very successful business, or, to quote Lord Sugar, the prune juice effect, meaning that, the huge revenues are just out the back door straight away because of the high wages, so there's very little profit margin. Mm. But what we're seeing in the past couple of years are private equity firms taking percentages of clubs and not necessarily wanting to run the club in terms of transfer, like who you sign in this transfer window. Of course they want the business to be run like a business. So you can see how a private equity firm from the US or elsewhere could buy a 30% stake. Sorry, that's a Freudian slip, isn't it?
Yeah, talking Man
could
City
buy
there.
A 30% stake in Arsenal and sit back and, not necessarily, in fact, not want to have control, not want to have the messiness of full control of a club, being a kind of silent partner, but still kind of keeping the reins when it comes to kind of whether it's run as a business or not. So in that respect, I don't think it'd be too difficult for him to find. But in fact, I think he'd find it extremely easy to find somebody to buy those 30%. Because realistically, if we look at football's trajectory and the potential for growth in the value of not just soccer teams, but of course in as a whole, but in TV revenues, in the ability to leverage commercial deals worldwide, I think that there'll be plenty of people who'd be interested in that. It's just he obviously doesn't want to, and it'll be who blinks. It'll be whether Kroenke will think it's more. If it's making money, Kroenke's going to stay, and if it gets too difficult to make a good profit, he'll go. It'll be that simple. I don't think he's going to hear protests or. There's nothing that will make any difference. It will just be about the bottom line. And if it just becomes too difficult to make profits, make it, relegation, for instance, which is something that he would never have experienced before in his life, that might be the only way to flush him out in that respect.
Yeah. Well, look, the way Arsenal season has started, it wouldn't rule that out. But look,
I'm a West Ham fan, so I'm not hearing any of this about, you're lucky.
It's all relative, isn't it? It really is. And look, it's a fascinating insight into the way that football is owned and being run. And probably, just finally before we go, do you think there's we talked about what they might have in common, but do you think there might be some kind of back channel world that we're not aware of where they're talking about what they might do with the game? Because there's got to be some kind of harmony between them if they all have ideas about making money and how to make more money, that perhaps, okay, look, this is the direction we want to bring this game in 10 years. Is that possible, or is that just me thinking conspiracy?
Oh, no, I mean, this is absolutely, I think, what's happening. When you see the convergence of interests, and I mentioned earlier about AC Milan and this kind of the Chinese owners making this, you know, plan that they would like to see a Champions League, you know, look very similar to what could then become a kind of NFL type competition that sits above everything else. I mean, we talk about this European Super League kind of bogeyman that's been for years, but I mean, you know, I mean, we kind of already have a European Super League. This would be, you know, the start of kind of a global Super League, which I think would be something even further afield and even more dangerous in that respect. And I think, you know, when I started writing the book, it was, you know, I was very aware I didn't want to make it about, you know, Johnny Foreigner coming over here and, you know, bringing their kind of shoddy ways, you know, because, you know, English owners, British owners are just as bad. And when you get to it, it's not about nationality. It's about wealth. And the billionaire class is kind of nationless in that respect. You know, they're at that level of wealth, they live in the same places. They holiday in the same places. They have exactly the same outlook. They have the exact same outlook on how to make their money, how to spend it, and how to keep it. So in that respect, there is a convergence of interest. There's a convergence because they understand what it is. And, you know, amongst the billionaire class, only the others in the billionaire class see that as a positive thing. So there is a convergence, not just in how they make their money, but in eventually how they would see any business, any industry, and for us, it's football. And I can definitely see how this kind of billionaires type of outlook on rationalizing the football industry and the football game, football as a game, is, you know, it's coming together regardless of where it's coming from, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's from China, whether it's from Thailand, whether it's from the US. It's coming together into a central idea, which is ultimately, how do we make the most out of the brands that we've bought and have out of our investment.
All right. Well, look, we've got lots to look forward to as football fans. James, we better leave it there. Listen, thank you very much indeed for your time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much indeed to James. The book is called The Billionaire's Club, The Unstoppable Rise of Football's Super Rich Owners, available now on Kindle, hardcover, and also audiobook. You can get it from amazon.co.uk, amazon.com. You'll find links on the main blog. Arsenal have got two super rich owners, and you wouldn't give tuppence for either of them. How very Arsenal, eh? Anyway, listen, hope you enjoyed this ad hoc, slightly off schedule Arscast. We will have one on Friday. I'm not sure exactly what we're going to do, given that the transfer window closes. I might do a late night recording on Thursday and see if we can get all the excitement of the transfer window into Friday's podcast. But we'll definitely have something for you. Remember, if you do like the show, you can give us a rating or a review on iTunes. That would be very, very much appreciated. Thank you as ever for listening. We'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.